Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron go deep into options. Not employee stock options, but calls and puts, the ones you can buy and sell on your own. Well, at least Trishul goes deep. He recalls previous strategies he executed in a past life as an options dealer and trader. Casinos and insurance companies get paid for taking on risk, but they also diversify risk to stay in business. Buying options may have a negative expected value, but sometimes the protection is worth the price. The key is figuring out when. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
Great to be here as well. So I help a lot of my clients with their stock options. It's one of the things that I have a little bit of expertise in, and we've talked about it in the past, but today we're going to take the word stock options and use it in an almost completely different sense. When I refer to stock options and I help my clients, it's usually employee stock options that are granted by a company. And this is different from options that you can buy on an exchange. So I'll have a little bit of kind of clarifying that difference, but going heavier into just options investing strategies. And some of the things Trishul has implemented in the past or has decided, you know what, this actually doesn't make sense for his different hedge strategies. The very basic, with employee stock option, you have the right to buy a stock at a certain price. Technically, this is actually a call option, where a call is the right to buy a stock at a specific price. So with an employee, it's granted to you, but if you can't actually go out into exchange and pay money to buy an option, so you own the option, you're long the option, so long as means you own it, and you're long a call. So you've paid money, you now own the right to buy a stock at a certain price. And what this does, it allows you to get more exposure. Some of the kind of the leverage components we've talked about as stock options in the past apply here, where the cost of the option is significantly less than the cost of the actual share price. So if you had $1,000 and the current stock price is $100, instead of buying 10 shares, you might be able to buy on the scale of 50 to 500 options. So 500 of $1,000, that might be too much. We'll get into pricing later, but you can buy significantly more options. And so if the price of that stock goes up above $100, you're amplifying your return by using this option. So an employee stock option, you have the right to buy a stock. You can also buy a call, the right to buy a stock at a certain price. Some of the differences, employee stock options are usually granted with much longer timeframes, usually 10 years. Most stock options on exchanges are much shorter, from the scale of a few days, few weeks, few months, maybe a year or two. But that's going to be the kind of the basis of our conversation today. When we talk about stock options, in the past, we're normally talking about employee stock options, but from that same perspective, we're talking about that call and other types of options and strategies that you can use when in either investing or hedging against other stock movements. So, Trishul, I described buying a call. Do you want to describe shorting and or puts and kind of finish out our intro to options?
Yeah. Happy to, Aaron. And that was a good introduction on a very base case that's very common of being in possession of a call, being the buyer of a call or being granted a call in air quotes by an employer. And the distinction I want to kind of make is when you're buying a call, you kind of have this notion of a lottery ticket where you put a little bit of money down. And if the market goes in your favor, you might end up with a lot of money. Whereas, you know, with a stock, if you buy $100 stock and the stock goes up $1, well, you've gained 1%. But, you know, with an option, a call option, if you bought that option and it went up a dollar, you may have put in, you know, just a few dollars, and it went up by the stock going up $1, your option position may have gone up a good amount. You may have in return space gone up 20-30% just by that $1 move. So you can see how there's this kind of gearing that can happen if things go in your way. But of course, you can lose all of your money that you put down pretty quickly if the option expires and you're not where the stock should be. So that's where, in terms of a lottery ticket, you know, you put a good amount of money down and you hope for the best. And if things go well, you make multiples of your money. And if things go poorly, well, you lose all your money. So that's kind of the basics of a call, where you can think about it as you're buying hopes and dreams, I guess. But, you know, if things are fairly priced, maybe it's not that bad of a deal. We'll talk about whether these are fairly priced towards the end of this conversation, but that's just something to think about.
Okay, so let me give some numbers just so we can use it for reference. I used a Black-Scholes calculator, and we might get into that later, but it's not that important. But if we have a stock that's currently at $100 and the option is the right to buy at $100, so it's an at-the-money option. We'll say it matures 1 year from now, and annual risk-free interest rate, I'm putting out 1%, you can change that later. And I'm saying annualized volatility is 15%, okay? The cost of that option is about $6.46, okay? Right. So, and if we say change the volatility a little bit, maybe reduce it, we can, so kind of depending on what the stock is, I think for our conversation, let's say the option costs $5, okay? So this is actually where I got to my buying 500 options idea, that if the stock price is $100 and if you have $1,000, you can buy 10 shares of stock. Or you can buy 200 options. Sorry, you can buy 200 options or 10 shares of stock. And so now if that stock goes from 100 to 110, it's about 10% increase in the stock price, then your 10 shares have gone from $1,000 to $1,100. But your 200 options have gone up, what are we doing? $2,000. Did I get that right? Yes. Yeah. So your 200 options are now worth $2,000. So that 10% increase, instead of going from $1,000 to $1,100, your $1,000 has gone to $2,000. That's the leverage component and kind of how much it can amplify your returns. Now, I didn't factor in the cost of the option at this point, but we might get to that. But that's just kind of helping you understand. I think it's a good example for us to use today. And $100 stock price, $100 exercise price or strike price, 1 year maturity, 1 year risk-free rate, 10-12% volatility. We'll say the option costs $5. I think that'll be a good case for us to use it in this conversation.
Yeah, so the notion is with putting less money down, you have the chance of getting a very large return. And with an option, that sounds great, because there may be a situation where you want those high risk types of rewards. But at the same time, Aaron, as you mentioned, there's the cousin of the call, there's the put option. And this is a situation where you can put also a little bit of money down And if things go your way, you might end up getting a lot of money back. Now, the way I think about a put option is, first of all, with a put option, you make more money if you buy a put if the market falls. So but in this case,
This is you're buying the right to sell.
Right.
At a certain price.
Yeah. And specifically what that means is as the market goes down, your put gets higher and higher in value. And the way I like to think about this is it's more like an insurance product where you pay a little bit of premium. Let's say you own the stock market and you're concerned that if the market falls, you're going to get hurt. Well, you can pay a little bit of money to buy this put. And if the market falls, well, then the put will be worth a lot of money. And that would help soften the losses that you have because you have your money invested in the market. So you can kind of think about the put, again, as this notion of insurance where you're just paying some premium. And over time, you're hoping that the market doesn't fall because, again, you're holding the market. But if it does, you feel a little safer because if the market does fall, well, then your put will help soften the blow.
Okay, so that's actually an interesting way of phrasing it in terms of that insurance side, because I guess I thought of the put as a kind of like shorting the stock. You're betting that the market will go down. That's how the put makes money. So if you have a put at $100, you've paid that $5 cost, and the stock drops from 100 down to 90, because you can sell at 100 and everyone else can sell at 90, that's why your put is more valuable now. You now have an in the money put. So maybe, I don't know if we want to get into it to now, maybe this is a good time. Kind of the insurance, would that be a covered put, I guess, or a put on a stock you already own, but a naked put would be a bet that the market's going down or that stock is going down.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. So a naked put is kind of just like that lottery ticket example of when you buy a call. If you buy a put and you have no other position, then you have a naked put. And it's like a lottery ticket on the market crashing, meaning you put a little bit of money down, and if the market crashes, then you might end up with a ton of money. So yeah, from that perspective, the naked put is a bet on the market falling. Whereas if you own the market and you buy the put, then we would call that a hedge, meaning you're softening the blow of your position if something bad happens.
Okay. So you still want the stock to go up because you own the stock, and your return is going to be reduced by the cost of the premium. But if the stock goes down, you have the right to sell at that higher price. So you're not hurt as much.
Right. And again, the reason you may do this is either you want to speculate, you want to buy that downside lottery ticket, or you want to reduce your risk, meaning you want to soften the blow of something bad happening.
Okay. So you buy a call with the right to, gives you the right to, you're buying the right to buy a stock at a, or market at a certain price. You're buying a put, it's the right to sell. The call is either a bet that the market's going up. We'll get into covered calls a little later. A naked put or the speculative side is a bet that the market's going down. But if you using the put as a hedge, it reduces your upside, the stock's going up, but does protect against that downside. So puts make money when the market's down. Calls make money when the market's up, when the stock is up.
Yeah, buying those two would make money in those situations. Yes.
Okay.
So what I want to mention though is also, rather than buying, you could be selling these options. So that kind of turns the tables. If you can think about the buying, the notion as being, you know, you're buying these bets, you're buying these lottery tickets. Well, if you're selling, you're kind of the bookkeeper or the house, meaning you own the casino, you're selling the lottery tickets now. And what that means is, you know, let's say you are selling these lottery tickets. Well, when you sell something, you collect some money and you hope that nobody wins the lottery, right? That would be the best. You collect little, you know, little bits of money from everybody and, you know, whoops, nobody won. Well, that's great. Now you have all this money in your pocket and you can, you know, sell some more bets. So that's what it means if you're the seller. You get to sell these contracts, these calls and puts to whoever wants to buy them. And you get to collect a little bit of money from everybody. But if the market does, you know, go up a lot or down a lot, well, then you might owe a lot of people some, or a handful of people a lot of money, in which case you might be hurting a bit. So you can see how being the seller might be better in most times, but be quite hurtful in a small minority of the times. Whereas being the buyer probably may not be that great during most times, but it, you know, when the lottery hits those few times, well, then you'll feel really great.
Yeah. So selling a call means you don't want the market or the stock to go up. You kind of don't care if it goes down or if it stays flat. You just don't want it to go up. Selling a put, you don't want the market to go down.
Right.
If you're selling, you'd rather have stability and flat prices so the stock stays the same. You're just collecting those premiums.
Yeah. And the analogy I use for the seller is, you know, you're either that casino or I guess it's our government that sells lottery tickets, right? So you're the house, basically.
Yeah.
And another way to think about it is you're the insurance company. You're selling all of these contracts for, you know, people on their home insurance, for example, mm-hmm. where if the tornado doesn't hit, you're fine. You just collect the money year in, year out. But you know, when that category 5 runs through one of your towns that you've sold a lot of policies on, well, then you might be in a good amount of trouble, or the earnings that year for your business are going to be hurting.
So that's interesting. So kind of side note, this is a reason why insurance companies are regulated, because they have to be able to pay out enough money when that thing does happen. So that's also why insurance companies, that it helps that they're really big, so that they're collecting premiums from all over the country, because you're not going to have a hurricane hit North Dakota. You might have a hurricane in Florida, an earthquake in California, and a tornado in Kansas, but hopefully like all those don't happen at the exact same time. But kind of you want a big insurance company that has very diversified risks across different natural disasters. So if there's just one state-specific insurance company that's covering the hurricanes in Florida, you might not want to use that insurance company.
Right. Yeah, and that analogy works pretty well in this space, because if you're going to be selling options, the best way to reduce your risk is to sell on many, many different markets so that you balance your risk. And if something bad happens in one area, it's okay. You're still collecting some premium in some other area to cover the potential losses that could happen in another area.
So if you're the house at a casino, you don't have just one craps table.
Right.
You have lots of craps tables and blackjack tables and slot machines and lots of other ways for people to pay you their little premiums.
Exactly. Yeah. So as you can imagine, what happens, and you know, this kind of ties into one of my former positions, I was in charge of managing an options book, and we were sellers. Our goal was to sell on as many different markets as possible. And you know, when I first joined, we had a few handful of markets, and by the time I left, we were covering, you know, dozens and dozens of markets. And what ended up happening is it really balanced out the amount of money we could make on a consistent basis, so that it became very predictable. It got to the point where you can just make these plays of selling these contracts all over the planet at that point, and it kind of balances out the risk. So what that kind of means, though, is if you consistently sell contracts, you're expected to kind of gain money over time because there's amount of premium that you want to collect above and beyond the, you know, the actual fair price of the contract, plus also fair, you need to be compensated for the risk you're taking. You know, the insurance company needs to be paid a little bit so that it can cover the amount of risk of something bad happening. So that's known as a risk premium or a volatility risk premium, meaning it's an extra, you can call it like a insurance premium that people pay for being a seller of a contract. Now, what that also means, though, is if you're consistently, if you sell, and the more you sell and the more diverse you sell, that you're expected to make money, you can guess kind of what that means if you're a consistent buyer of options in terms of your expectation over time.
So it sounds like the consistently buying options, you're not only just like trying to match the fair value and kind of, it's not going to be exactly zero expected value. It sounds like you know you're giving up that small edge to the sellers.
Exactly, yeah. If you're consistently buying, it's like always buying lottery tickets. Your expected value is in fact negative. You're expected to lose money over time if you keep doing it. Now, again, the reason people do it is because they are hopeful or dreamful of winning that big one. Or those sets of big ones.
Okay, so if you're selling, you're more like the insurance company where it's kind of really risky if you're only selling one contract. But if you're selling lots of contracts, you're diversified enough that it can be a, I don't want to say stable, but at least less risky investment strategy. And if you're buying, you're giving up some premium in exchange for something, either that lottery ticket, which really has a negative expected value, but if it pays off big, or you're doing it from an kind of insurance perspective of protecting against the downside. You get to hold on to your stock and limit your losses on that stock. So you've reduced your risk. So you're paying money out of pocket to reduce that risk.
Right. And, you know, one way to think about this is, let's say you do hold the stock market, you're concerned about it falling, so you buy some puts, and you compare that with, you know, alternate universe Aaron, and alternate universe Aaron just holds a stock market. Well, over time, which one is expected to have more money with less risk?
I would be the one who's just holding the stock over a long enough time frame. Well, but I think I've taken on more risk. Like if I am holding the stock versus holding the stock and buying puts, my expected return of just holding the stock is higher, but I think my risk is also slightly higher. Wouldn't buying a put be reducing my risk slightly?
Yeah, so it's interesting because assuming there's no extra premium that goes to the sellers, then it kind of evens out. You're in the same situation, meaning the risk you give up for the downside protection is the upside, right?
Yeah.
But it balances out. However, the fact that you are paying the premium to a seller means you're taking money out of the system and you're putting it in the pocket of somebody who's going to buy something else. Like a new car or some new clothes or something like that. In that case, money is leaving this closed system, right? In the scenario where you're paying for protection. So at the end of the day, you'll, on average, if you take, you know, large samples, be worse off by buying the protection. Although, you know, emotionally, you might feel better because you feel safer.
Yeah.
So that you've traded off one form of energy from another, you know, if we're conserving.
I've traded dollars for emotion.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So if I own the stock, buying puts protecting against the downside, while it does reduce my risk, it actually also reduces my risk-adjusted return because of that risk premium going to the seller. So kind of I'm reducing my risk, but I'm reducing my return by slightly more.
Right. And I just qualify that slightly. In fact, it can eat into a good amount of your upside if you do have this strategy on all the time. Meaning if you constantly want to protect your downside.
If I'm always protecting against the downside, then right. I might be giving up. So in our case, that the cost of the option was 5% of the stock price, I could be giving up on the scale of 5% per year, something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. So there's no free lunch. It is, you know, part of the game here. If you want to dabble in the markets and you like the upside, you're going to have to take on some risk. If you want to indemnify yourself from downside, then you're going to give up probably way too much of the upside for it to be worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So one other strategy I have seen used is a covered call strategy. Mm-hmm. Do you mind? So we talked about the kind of the naked put is speculative, but it, covered call is not speculative. Do you mind that this is when I own the stock and now I'm selling calls against the stock that I own?
Yeah. So in this case, you're selling a bit, meaning you're taking on risk of if the market goes up, then you got to pay somebody a lot of money. But it's called a covered call because you own the stock as well. So if the market goes up, you've made back that money by owning the stock.
Okay,
what that means is, yep.
So if I have my $100 stock price, I'd want to sell calls at like 110 or 120. Mm-hmm. So my premium is lower, so I'm only getting a little bit. But if the stock goes up enough to get called away, that someone actually will buy it from me at 120, mm-hmm. that means the stock went up above 120. So I get the benefit of seeing my stock go from 100 to 120, I just lose all the upside from that 120 on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of, I get some return if the stock doesn't go up because I get that premium of selling the calls.
Mm-hmm.
And if the stock goes up a lot, I still get some of that upside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of it feels like win-win, but it's like win and win less.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's that win less amount, meaning there's a small chance that it'll get called away, but when it does, you're giving up a large opportunity. So you can imagine over time, most of the time it looks like you're winning because you get to keep the stock and you get to earn a bit of premium by selling these call options. However, there will be small occasions now and then that will basically cost you a lot, meaning a lot of opportunity on that stock that you would have gained on had you not done the call portion of your position.
Okay. So yeah, so like kind of, I did a quick calculator. If a stock's currently at 100 and exercise price is 120, the option, if I sell it, might be a dollar. So I might be able to kind of increase my return by 1% per year as long as the stock stays under 120. But as soon as the stock goes above that, if it goes to kind of 130, which is a 30% return, that's a very realistic possibility, I've given up kind of a decade's worth of return,
right.
Kind of that 1% per year.
Yeah, so then this begs a similar question. Let's say we have Aaron and we have Bizarro Aaron again. So Aaron in this case holds just the stock and doesn't do anything fancy. But Bizarro Aaron decides to also hold the stock but sell calls to make it a covered call. In which case, you know, over long periods of time running this simulation over many iterations, who is likely going to end up with more money with less risk?
So I would have thought that because I'm collecting that risk premium, it'd be that. But I do know just kind of stocks go up enough over a long enough time frame that it's very, very likely at least 1 year within that decade, you're going to see a jump of at least 20%, if not close to 30%. Right? I don't know which year it'll happen, but one of those years I'll see that jump. And so my almost kind of best case scenario is getting something like a 19% return on my stock plus a 1% return per year on my premium, but never going above that.
Right. What we're probably going to get into very shortly is the notion that these contracts are priced fairly. They're not priced such that somebody has an unfair advantage by pulling off one sort of strategy versus another. And in this context, what that kind of means is if you're selling that call for the covered call portion, well, you should collect a premium for doing that. And that's, you know, money you would generate as for taking on that risk. And there's a positive expectation to that, as we kind of mentioned. Mm-hmm. However, you're then holding the stock, so you're reducing your risk. You're hedging that premium. And what you might be doing is kind of mitigating most of that risk by holding that stock.
Oh, so if kind of the only way for my, not necessarily the only way, but for my option for selling the call to have a positive expected value kind of implies the stock that I own doesn't go up.
Yeah.
So I'm benefiting in the scenario that that doesn't pay me off with the other thing I own. I'd almost, although if I own the stock, I'd rather the stock went up than didn't.
Right.
But now I'm benefiting in that one scenario where now I don't want the stock to go up. So I want to give up return on the stock to make money on the option. I feel like that's the cutting off your nose to spite your face kind of thing.
Right. The high level deal here is that there's no free lunch here. You know, it may sound good to have a covered call strategy, but you are giving up something. Yeah. And that giving up may end up such that you're either at a wash, or once you factor in, you know, transaction costs and fees and taxes, well, then you may be much worse off thinking of all of these things.
I got to pay taxes on my all my income from selling calls.
Yeah. And also if it gets called away, well, now you just sold your stock, right, to cover the...
Oh, yeah.
Whereas
paying capital gains taxes, yeah.
Yeah. So Bizarro Aaron is going to get a pretty good tax bill, whereas normal Aaron is going to still be, yeah, buying and holding and letting his gains continue to be tax deferred.
I do like the idea that regular Aaron is buy and hold Aaron.
Yeah, it looks like nice. Regular Aaron has a little sensibility going for him in this scenario.
Yeah. Okay, so we got buy and selling calls, buy and selling puts. You do naked puts is a bet that the market will go down. A covered call can make you some money if your stock doesn't go up, but you're probably better off just holding on the stock. What are some other... I feel like we got all the basics now. So right. What are some other stock and hedging strategies that exist that you may or may not have implemented in the past?
So now here's where things start to get a little more fancy. And before we get too far, let me circle back to how these things are actually priced. And that's what you mentioned in the beginning of this conversation, the Black and Scholes equation. So with the Black and Scholes equation, the big insight here was with just five numbers, you can figure out, in theory, you know, air quotes, with a bunch of assumptions in air quotes, the price of an option.
It's a theory that everyone seems to agree on, sort of.
Kind of, sort of, maybe.
In air quotes.
Technical star, footnote, et cetera.
It's the, everyone agrees this is the best, like, this is maybe not that great, but we don't have anything better.
Well, so lots of hedging here because I don't want to open too many cans of worms.
Okay.
But
there
what
is something
called?
Exists called Black-Scholes option pricing model. This Black-Scholes option pricing model exists.
Yes, it exists. In the industry, we call it the wrong formula with the wrong inputs to get the right price. And I'll attempt to explain that one, but it's a bit of a mind bend to actually close the loop on that. But before we get too far, let me just explain a little bit of just about the Black and Scholes. So the inputs, as I mentioned, that part is hopefully straightforward, where if you have five numbers, you can predict the fair price of an option. And three of these numbers are known, so it's even easier. If you know what the strike is, mm-hmm. you know, what are you aiming to be? The stock must be above $120 to make money for the call. Well, you need the strike, and then that's the price you need to beat. Then there's actually the current price of the stock that's known as the spot price. So it's currently trading at $100, and if it goes above 120, well, that call will be worth something. Mm-hmm. So that the second number is the spot price. And then the third number is what's the duration of this contract? Is it for 1 month, a day, a year, and so on? So you'll need to know that. You'll also need to know this notion of drift, which is the interest rates that and the dividends that are affecting this stock. So it's called drift because it'll cause the stock to move either up or down. When you get a dividend, it pushes the stock price down. Money leaves the company. And when you get interest, the risk-free rate will help push the price up. And you throw those numbers in to the Black and Scholes equation. It's a partial differential equation. You get a price.
You need one more. So
the last number, sorry, the most important, which is the volatility. How volatile is this instrument going to be over this period? And it's actually interesting because this is based on embedded within the Black and Scholes formula is this notion of geometric Brownian motion or Brownian motion. And it's based on this process that kind of pulls from physics, where if you kind of think about it, a stock price is this randomly moving, if you plot it on the chart, this dot that moves up and down in one axis for, you know, up is higher in price and down is lower in price, and then it moves forward in time. So it has similarities to like a particle moving through space, where instead of in three dimensions, it just moves through one dimension in spatial, one spatial dimension and one dimension in time. So that's where the randomness component of like a particle moving through space, that type of formulation was pulled into this equation, where, you know, you have this atom in space and it keeps bouncing around, right? And as it moves through time, and, you know, let's say you have a fan in the room, well, that's going to push the particle in a certain direction. That's this component of drift that's in the Black and Scholes equation. And the randomness is part of this Brownian motion component, where we talked about these notions of random variables, where the way it works is you have the stock's current position or a particle's current position. And to figure out the next position, you have a jump someplace. And that jump, that the amount of distance it jumps is based upon a randomness, a bit of noise. So it might jump up or down by a random amount that's dictated by a normal distribution. And what that meant for us is the higher the volatility, the more chances that it'll jump further away or jump, the particle will move further away or the stock price will move further up or down. Mm-hmm. So the interesting notion here is that if you know these five numbers, you can predict with accuracy what the price of a stock will be. And the tricky part is two of these numbers, the drift component, the dividends and interest rates, and the second number, the volatility, are frankly unknown. Although we have a fairly good understanding of what dividends might be because they're fairly regular and it's somewhat easier to model those. But future volatility is the hard part. meaning if we could predict the future volatility with certainty, then we could do very well at picking a price of an option. But one of the big assumptions with Black-Scholes is that volatility remains constant over the period of the option, meaning for the following year, volatility will be constant. And yeah, as we know, things change. Viruses show up in the middle of, you know, February where they shouldn't. And that's kind of why Black-Scholes is not a one-size-fits-all. In fact, we know, and we can even understand, the volatility won't likely be common. So in fact, in most more sophisticated option pricing models, they will not assume a constant volatility. They will assume that volatility changes over time. Over, let's say, the next year, it might go up and down and left and right, and they might model that. They might use this notion of localized volatility to come up with a better estimate for the option price.
Okay, so I guess my question I don't want you to answer is, what is a better model? But
so, yep,
I feel like I don't want to go down that path. I want to try to get back to other, actually, option strategies.
Yeah, I won't go too deep. I can give the 30,000 feet, you know, view of, you know, just different better models that the market uses, or professional pricers or market makers might use to price these things. Basically, initially, what they did is they realized that Black-Scholes wasn't great because it had these concerns and it didn't account for certain things. So they started adding fudge factors to Black-Scholes to account for them. So that they realized, for example, that as vol changes, the volatility will change. So the volatility of volatility is something to throw into the model. So they added a fudge factor for that. And they also realized that as a stock price gets higher, the sensitivity to changes in the stock price might change. So they added a fudge factor for that. And what they started doing is creating basically a Black-Scholes monster with all of these fudge factor types of things put into place. But then over time, they started to add more horsepower. So in fact, the more sophisticated models that are used by the larger banks these days are based on Monte Carlo simulations. So what they actually do is they take a Brownian motion, they take a stock price and they simulate it into the future. And then they just say, okay, what percent of these pads out of these 10,000 pads ended up above the strike price? So it's a pretty novel way of simulating the price of an option that kind of backs into the price using more horsepower.
I do kind of like hearing that just being a huge fan of Monte Carlo simulations in general, but also right, understanding that they're getting this kind of range of potential outcomes and then applying statistics on what is our median, what's our range, and adding in a probabilistic result to understanding what truly is a unknown future scenario. So now it's like, here, this isn't necessarily the price, but we are reasonably confident the price should be within this range. And we're very confident the price is definitely within this much bigger range, and allows us to kind of get closer to a median, but acknowledging, like, yeah, we could be off by this amount one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. So these like state-of-the-art models, oh boy, this was 10 years ago. So I think we've evolved from them, but they were called stochastic local volatility models. And the goal, if you're selling these things, is to come up with a better model than all the competitors, because what that means is you can decide, you know, which markets do you feel more confident in your pricing, and you can sell those and hopefully avoid the ones that are harder to price, or sell those at a more expensive price and hope somebody bites.
Yeah.
So what that means, though, is if you're going to be dabbling in these options beyond just your standard calls and puts and your hedge trades or your covered calls. There are ways so that you can take these calls and puts and use them as kind of Lego blocks to come up with different types of strategies, such that if you want either to speculate and obtain money if certain things happen, you can do it by zeroing in on what you specifically want to speculate on. The next one I want to think about is something known as a straddle. This is something you may have heard before. The way I like to think about it is it's a play on, if you're buying the straddle, it's a play on if the market goes up a lot or down a lot, you make money.
Mm-hmm.
But if it stays close to where it is, you will not make money. You will lose money. So what you're
kind of betting
on
volatility either way. You kind of don't care if it goes up or down as long as it's big.
Yeah. So in that case, you are known as being long volatility. You're hoping that volatility will increase from where it is. You don't care if the stock price goes up or down. You just hope things get more erratic.
Okay. So is this buying a call and a put that are out of the money right now?
A straddle would be the same strike, so that they're both at the money.
Okay. So then you just kind of need to profit. You need the stock to move greater than the cost of the premium, the combined cost of the premiums.
Combined cost of the premium, yeah. On each side, yeah.
Okay.
And what that means is, if you're buying this contract, if it just moves in either direction, you make some money.
Okay.
However, so
if I spend $5 on a call, I spend $5 on a put, so they're both at $100 strike price, $100 current spot price. I need it to either go above 110 or below 90 to profit.
Right. It has to go above or below the amount you paid, the premium you paid, the amount you bet to make this happen.
Okay.
And what that basically means is, if you're selling this option, well, that means you're short volatility. You're hoping things don't change.
Okay, so
if you're selling
this straddle
input,
is short volatility.
Right.
Okay.
You're hoping that things stay calm, and you know, if things do, then you'll collect that premium and you'll, you know, buy a Coke.
Okay. Okay, so we got a straddle. What's next?
Okay, next thing is a strangle.
Okay.
Now, in this case, you're hoping that volatility changes a lot. So you buy an out of the money. If you're buying a strangle, you're buying an out of the money call and you're buying an out of the money put. So, you know, instead of having the strike be at 100, it would be at like 110 for the call and at 90 for the put. So now you still pay some money, but you pay less money because the stock has to move a lot more for you to make money on either direction, right?
Okay. So instead of spending 5 on the call and 5 on the put, I'm spending 1 or 2 on each.
Right. Meaning you're putting less down, but the stock has to move a lot more for you to make money either direction.
If I'm spending 2 on each of those and it's at 110, and like buy a call at 110, buy a put at 90, my total premium is 4. I need the stock to go above 114 or below 86 for this to pay off.
Yeah. So then if you're the seller of this arrangement, it just seems like at this point you're collecting less money than you would with the straddle, because it's just a lower likely event for the stock to move that much.
Yeah.
So then this kind of begs the question for normal Aaron and bizarre Aaron, which one is more likely to provide Aaron or bizarre Aaron with more money after adjusting for risk, buying the strangle or buying the straddle?
Ooh, I was not expecting that question. Okay. I guess because I think that the lottery tickets have the lower expected value. I think the strangles are less likely to pay off and the straddles are more likely to pay off. I'm going to guess the straddle has the higher expected value.
So if you're buying, the expected value is negative in both cases.
Yes.
In which case, which one would you lose?
I think I
lose money over
time. I think I lose less money on the straddle. I lose more money on the strangle. That is my guess. I've never actually thought about this before, comparing those two.
Right. So it kind of just evens out that there's like this invisible hand here where you're putting less money, but you're less likely to lose in the case of the strangle versus the straddle. So essentially there's no one better strategy than the other. Although, you know, if you're talking situations where there's a negative expectation, it's probably, you know, just if you're looking for the lesser of two evils, then you may think that if you put less down, you know, that might be the better way to go. But at the end of the day, you just might buy more contracts, right? By putting less down. And at the end of the day, if you're putting the same amount of money to work, you'll probably end up at the same place over time.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So if I was to spend the same amount on buying straddles versus strangles, I'll have, what, 2 to 5 times more contracts with the strangle because they cost less.
Right.
And my expected return would be similar.
Yeah. So once you account for the fact that you need to buy more contracts to get the same bang for the buck, then you're kind of back to where you started.
Okay.
So, you know, long story short, you can combine these things into an infinite amount of combinations. Part of what I used to do is turn these into a class of options known as exotic options, where you can get pretty fancy. You can figure out the price of options for, you know, let's say, what's the price of an option if the S&P is up 20% next year? And if it's up, you win, you get back $10,000 or something, and you pay a certain amount up front. You can even come up with a price of what if it stays between 90 and 110 for the entire year. This is like a range option. Mm-hmm. Is it going to stay in the range or is it going to go out of this range? And then there's this class of options known as Asian options, where you say it's going to be above this average price for the next year, meaning I buy a contract that's going to pay me a good amount of money if the S&P on average is more than $100 for the year. So all this really does is this takes the formulations of option prices or those Monte Carlo simulations and just takes different chunks of those outcomes and says, okay, I win if these small sets of chunks, you know, mm-hmm. go in my favor.
Yeah.
But you can do that because you have this expectation and you have this simulation and you have this data to come up with these prices. And, you know, the last thing I'll add is you can kind of use this to your advantage to understand what the market thinks. For example, you can use the price of options to back into the chances that the market thinks the S&P will be up 10% next year, because that's embedded in the option prices.
Yeah. Okay. So what else, when you think of different option strategies that you've used in the past that we can understand? Like, I do know there's collars. I was wondering if you could make sure we got to that today.
Yeah, I'll lay out a few more of these types of things, but I won't go into too much detail because literally there's a ton of them.
Okay. But
you can kind of understand that once you have these Lego blocks, you can combine them to come up with pretty much any sort of payout you want, meaning you can pay, if you're the buyer, you can pay a little money and you can say, I only want to be paid if the S&P closes between 5% and 8% next year, or down negative 9% and down negative 12%. So you can literally do this and someone on the other end will happily pay you or collect your premium to do that.
This actually reminds me of Super Bowl prop bets. I don't know if you know sports betting well enough, but there's always a line, a spread line, and then there's also an odds line. So if you just want to bet that this team will win, one team is favored, so the payout is less. One team is the underdog, so the payout is more. But for the Super Bowl, they do dozens, if not hundreds, of alternate lines and alternate spreads where, okay, I'm very confident the favorite will win, but I don't know if they'll cover the spread. So I want, but I don't want to do just the betting line. So I want to increase the spread. So one team's favored by 7 points in the Super Bowl. Like, no, I want to, what is it if I think this team will at least be within 20 points? I think at least, or it'll be at least within 14. And then there's so many alternate lines and they adjust the odds for each one accordingly. And it's just, they print out pages upon pages of these different prop bets. And this is what it's starting to sound like. They're like, yeah, you pick a line that you think is going to happen and we'll go ahead and take your money for it.
Right. Because as we've said, there's a premium baked into all of these, you know, bets.
Yep.
So, you know, the collar or the protective collar, the notion here is that, let's say you own a position that's gone up a lot, you're long the stock, and now you're concerned about it going back down. So you hedge. In that case, you would buy an out of the money put. Mm-hmm. You know, if it drops more than 10%, you want to be paid to soften your blow.
Yep.
But to cover the cost of that put, well, you can sell an out of the money call. So you can use that premium that you get from selling the out-of-the-money call to buy the out-of-the-money put. And again, it's a covered call because you own the actual underlying. So even if it goes up, you sold the call, it went up, oops, that's bad, but you already own the stock, so you've covered your position a bit.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it by combining the selling the call and buying the put at the same cost, there's no out-of-pocket cost to you, and you're kind of locking in kind of your what you've already gained, sort of like it's you've already seen it gone up enough and you'd be okay selling at this price, but you prefer to hold on to the stock, whether it's maybe for tax reasons, you just don't want to see the stock go down and you don't want to have to pay anything out of pocket to do so.
Yeah. You know, like a good reason for this is, let's say it's been 11 months and 15 days, and in 15 days you get long-term capital gains treatment, but you're worried it's going to fall. Well, you know, you could do something like this.
Yeah.
Okay. So there may be a time and the place for these types of strategies, but I'd say it may be few and far between, but if it does come up, it's nice to know they're there. But I'd say overall, probably use them sparingly if you need to.
Yeah, I think the insurance example, the insurance analogy is a really good one, because the times that these might come into play is if you own a significant amount of company stock and you either want or need to hold on to it, but your net worth will be significantly impacted if it went down, and you're trying not to sell, again, maybe it's for tax reasons, maybe it's for other reasons related to the company, some of these strategies can help you protect your net worth. Now, anytime you're doing this with company stock, there's a lot of other rules to follow that you say if you're in a lockout period, you can't sell a put or buy, you can't buy a put to protect against it because you can't be considered trading in that stock, and trading and options on that stock are functionally the same, and you get in kind of the same level of trouble. So it's sometimes you just have to hold on to that risk. But there are times where using some kind of hedge strategy can makes sense for you. I like your example of you've held it for 11 months and 15 days. You're trying to do just another couple of weeks to get long-term capital gains, but you're worried about volatility over those last couple of weeks.
Yep. Well, good stuff, Aaron.
Okay. Any other final strategies you want to share that you've seen or implemented? Or do you think there's just too many? And if anyone's really interested in learning more, they can contact you.
I think so. I think I'll just sum it up with the notion that if you have a chance to be the casino or the person who shows up at the casino to spend their money, I'd say try to be the casino. But if you're going to be the casino, you really better manage your risk. So I'd also say that. At the end of the day, I think you mentioned just the notion that there might be a compelling reason every now and then. Usually it involves taxes on why this mm-hmm. might make sense. So I think I'd probably just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing everything about calls, puts, straddles, strangles, collars, and kind of et cetera, et cetera. So thank you for that. I learned a little bit more about the Brownian, what was it? The Brownian model.
Brownian motion.
Yep. Brownian motion, yeah, there you go. That was a new one for me. So I appreciate that. So thank you very much for your time, Trishel.
All good, Aaron. I enjoyed digging into this stuff as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, do spread the word. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.